because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God
bless you. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, and it's a special edition of Rewind because we're going to spend a lot of time talking about how Governor Walker did at the second GOP presidential debate. So we've again asked Brandon Schultz. He's a political consultant. He's a member of the Wisconsinite board, and in a previous life, he was executive director of the Wisconsin Republican Party. Brandon, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I said, we're going to spend some time talking about that debate last night. Mm-hmm. Governor Walker was one of 11 at the Reagan Library. Amazing scenario. An airplane in the background. You could hear that take off. First of all, overall question, how do you think the governor did, JR?
The universal opinion I got from people today talking to him was he started well, and then he faded the background. And part of it was the format. You have 11 people up there, so you're kind of fighting for time. So when he got his opportunity early on, he really went after Trump. He had a couple good lines he had in can to kind of bring out, use against them. Good job there. But then as it became a free-for-all, if you will, he wasn't throwing the sharp elbow to get more time. He did interject a few different times on other things, but he wasn't as forceful as he could have been. Now, it could be the Midwestern nice kind of thing, or it's not his personality, but you had others like Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Carly Fiorina, who more dominated the conversation, and Walker got overshadowed because of that. And you saw that his trajectory kind of go up and then peter back out as it, by the time it was done.
Brandon, last time you were here, you said you were a homer, and pulling for Governor Walker, but how did he do last night, second debate?
You know, I think he did much better because in that first debate, the strategy was do no harm, just hang back. In this debate, I thought he was much more on message. He wanted to get some of those points out. I agree with JR that it was tough after the first half because he was part of the 11 who kept screaming, Jake, 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 call on me, call on me. And that really is a debate format that really doesn't cater to somebody. Most of those people on stage who needed to get some specific message points out. So what the governor had to work with, I think he did a good job. Did he get what he needed to get? He didn't get as much time as he had to get.
It was interesting. He got, I think, 3 questions for the entire 3-hour debate.
He did.
Now, his people are not happy about that today, but if you look at his state in the polls right now, I mean, that might be a proportion to where you're at number-wise. He's in 10th place, so maybe that's part of it. But one thing that was interesting, too, some people pointed out to me, was a couple times he got a question like on minimum wage, and he turned it into, rather than a minimum wage answer, into a kitchen sink answer of, I have to hit my repeal of Obamacare, X, Y, and Z before my time is up, and they cut me off, so he kind of blurted it all out right in one shot, and so it wasn't the best answer in that way too, which didn't help his kind of like the response you saw to him a little bit as well.
But Brandon, he had to do so much better because of the slide in the polls in the last 3 months, didn't he?
I think every candidate up there had to do better with the exception of Trump, and that's a separate sideshow. So yeah, they all had to hit a point. Fiorina is in there for the first time. Mm-hmm. She has to hit a home run. Kasich has to hit home runs. Rubio has to maintain where the rest of them have to stay in the game. And again, in that format, it's so difficult to do it. So the other thing was, and you're talking about Walker and the minimum wage comment mm-hmm. or question, you know, in the debate, he did what he did, as most other candidates do. They give you 10 seconds on your question, and then they want to get the rest of the message. But Tapper took the time to, you know, accost Walker of saying, well, you didn't answer the question, so let me go to you, whoever he went to.
And we're going
to
be showing that answer. Based on the governor's performance, are his supporters, his contributors, going to continue to write those 6-figure checks, Brandon?
I think they will. I think, you know, this is the point where everybody starts to look a little bit of a panic. And remember when the caucus is. Remember when
February 1,
and
Iowa.
Remember when New Hampshire comes.
Followed by New Hampshire and then South Carolina.
So look at the candidates prior to all of what's going on now. How much money did they raise before? What did they bank? How many people did they put on the ground? What kind of infrastructure did they build in front when they had the momentum? Is that enough to sustain where they're going to go? If you go way, 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 way back to George Bush 1, remember what happened. Okay in Iowa, mm-hmm. tanked in North New Hampshire. But where was the firewall? South Carolina. It was Lee Atwater's strategy to have that firewall built in South Carolina so he could sustain and keep going. I think Walker has some similar strategy. They're not putting a dime in New Hampshire. They're letting it go. They're going to put most of their marbles now in Iowa and then take it to South Carolina. And if you remember, Rick Wiley said a long time ago, We just want to punch our ticket to keep going to the next one. And I still think that's where they're pushing.
Okay, let's take a look at actual four clips from the debate. And we did it in the chronological order. So the first one is 15 minutes into the debate, the governor engages Donald Trump. Let's listen to that.
And Mr. Trump, we don't need an apprentice in the White House. We don't need an apprentice in the White House. We have one right now. He told us all the things we wanted to hear back in 2008. We don't know who you are or where you're going. We need someone who can actually get the job done.
In Wisconsin, you're losing $2.2 billion right now.
You're using the talking. I would do so much better than that. You want to talk about balanced budgets? You took four major projects into bankruptcy over and over and over again. You can't take America into bankruptcy. That's what's wrong with the politicians in Washington right now. They think we can take a country into bankruptcy.
I never went bankrupt, by the way, as you know, everybody knows. But when the folks of Iowa found out the true facts of the job that you've done in Wisconsin, all of a sudden you tubed. He was number one, now he's number six or seven in the polls. So, look, we brought it out. You were supposed to make $1 billion in the state. You lost 2.2. You have right now a huge budget deficit. That's not a Democratic point. That's a point. That's a fact. And when the people of Iowa found that out, I went to number one, and you went down the tubes.
Just because he says it doesn't make it true. The facts are the facts. We balanced a $3.6 billion budget deficit. We did it by cutting taxes $4.7 billion to help working families, family farmers, small business owners, and senior citizens. And it's about time people in America stand up and take note of this. If you want someone who can actually take on the special interest of Washington, which you yourself just said you were part of, using the system, we need somebody who's going to stand up and fight for average Americans to put them back in charge of the government. I'm the one who's taking that on. I'll do that as your next president.
Let's move on.
Two questions. Was it wise for Governor Walker to interject himself, go at Trump at 15 minutes into the debate, and did Governor Walker win that exchange? Brandon.
I think he did win, and I think he had to do it early. He couldn't wait till the end. You got to be one of the first people. If you're gonna do something to Trump, you got to do it right away. And the engagement there was pretty good. I mean, it's also tough to go after somebody who's got earplugs in and doesn't care what you say, and also doesn't, you know, is fast and footloose with the facts that Trump uses after. So he's an insulting man. He's all about, you know, putting somebody down. I think Walker did a good job in the front end. He did what he had to do.
JR, does anybody care that Trump's number on the budget deficit was wrong?
His supporters, look, we watched the first debate and thought, okay, this guy really made mistakes. His numbers went up. So I don't know what to interpret what's going to happen after this debate, what his numbers will do, but it's a pattern with him where he kind of throws things out there. And, you know, Walker is right. You can't use your own, or you can't make up facts, if you will. But for Donald, it's not about being right on the numbers. It's the show. It's the presentation, if you will. I'm very successful. You know, I do better than you would, kind of thing. So that's part of his shtick, it seems like.
Okay, now let's take a look at the issue. The question was minimum wage, and the governor, as you guys alluded to earlier, talked about the skills and education. So let's listen to that segment.
I want to turn to that issue
because you said I did answer, and I did. I said, to me, I think the real focus shouldn't be, you know, Hillary Clinton talks about the minimum wage. That's her answer to grow the economy. The answer is to get people the skills and the education so they make far more than minimum wage. I don't want to argue about how low things are going to be. I want to talk about how do we lift everyone up in America. That's what Reagan talked about. It wasn't how bad things were. It was how to make it better for everyone. That's what we've done in Wisconsin. That's exactly what we do.
JR, was it a contradiction for the governor to talk about skills and education when his budget that he signed cut $250 million over 2 years to the UW system?
Well, he would argue that's about job training and that they put resources into that, so that's kind of his point. But if you listen to that whole exchange, it becomes the checklist of, like, things he wants to drop. He mentioned Ronald Reagan, you know, job training, education. So it became very much a kitchen sink answer for him there to cover all these things because, okay, I'm losing time. I got to get something in there right now to get my marker down, if you will.
Was he effective in that answer, Brandon?
I think he was, because you could get on into the nuances of budget cuts and why were certain things cut or why were other programs. That's not part of this debate.
Right.
This debate is about where he's going to come from, that people can understand this is what's important to him: education, training, growing jobs, those things. The nuances of what happened in the budget, it's not for this debate.
Okay.
Maybe later on, but not at this point.
Okay, the third segment that I highlighted and want to play is what I'm going to call the governor wearing his commander-in-chief hat. And what intrigues me here is the governor spoke here with passion. He looked right into the camera. And here is a governor who did not serve in the military, but he has two draft-age sons. And that's what I kind of picked up in the last part of this answer. So this is what I'm calling his commander-in-chief answer.
Barack Obama's administration has put political restrictions on the military personnel already in Iraq. We need to lift those, and then we need to listen to our military experts, not the political forces in the White House, but our military experts about how many more we send in. And we certainly shouldn't have a commander-in-chief who sends a message to our adversaries as to how far we're going to go and how far we're willing to fight. So I'm not putting a troop number on. What I'm saying is lift the political restrictions. When you do that, you empower our military personnel already there to work with the Kurd and the Sunni allies to reclaim the territory taken by ISIS, and to do so in a way that allows that ISIS doesn't go back in Syria, as we were just talking about here. That is the fundamental problem going forward. We have a president, and Hillary Clinton, who's a part of this, by the way, who has made political decisions for our men and women in uniform. I want the men and women at home to know, if I am commander-in-chief, I will only send you into harm's way when our national security is at risk. And if we do, you know you'll have our full support, the support of the American people, and you'll have a clear path for victory.
Thank you.
The governor had been criticized earlier in the campaign for not knowing enough about some of these foreign affairs issues and military. Now, am I wrong in saying that was a pretty clear statement? Was that his best statement yet on these issues?
I think from a leadership standpoint in making sure our military is strong and our country is safe, that was as clear cut of a commitment and a leadership commitment on his part than maybe what he's done before. I haven't seen every speech he's given, but you know, that was about as solid as it could get.
You agree, Jan?
Well, the issue, if you talk to Governor Walker's campaign people, they'll tell you that he is really boned up on foreign policy, that he really dug into it, and he enjoys the study, if you will. The issue with that answer was the closing line was quite good, you know, looking the camera. But if you listen to the first part of the answer, it was all platitudes. There's no, like, depth, if you will, to show that, look, I'm a governor who has a deep understanding of what's going on here. You could have easily crafted that a little bit differently to kind of dive into a couple of details. That, I think, is a little more effective. It's just kind of a little too general, if you will. Closing line was great, but the first part, give me some more depth, some more meat to show you've got that knowledge, because he is fighting the perception of, well, you're a governor, what do you know about foreign policy?
Okay, before we listen to the fourth segment, which is his closing, I'm going to ask this. He went, by my count, 36 minutes for not being part of that debate. And the issue of immigration, he didn't play on. Now, is that a problem that he didn't interject himself? Because, as you said, Carly was Jake, and others were saying, is it a problem to go 36 minutes in a major debate like this without speaking?
I don't think you append it to Walker as his fault. I mean, you look at the format of that debate, and if you go back in that 36 minutes, how many split frames of there was Trump and somebody else? Every time one candidate mentioned another candidate's name, they gave them time to respond. So there wasn't a way that Walker could get into it other than screaming Jake, too. And if nobody mentioned his name, CNN wasn't going to let him into the debate. So the format was against him and others that had big gaps when they couldn't get in. I mean, you know, most of the time you didn't know Chris Christie was there because the camera never got that far off the end of the stage. So I don't know that you say Walker messed up by not getting in 36 minutes. That's a hard thing to break into, because that debate was just all over the place. It went from this side to this side. What about me? It was a cluster.
JR, in the spin room, the governor told reporters, short of tackling someone, I don't know what more I could have done to get called on. So that 36-minute gap, I mean, could the governor have been more active?
Well, a couple of things. With immigration being the main issue during that period, if you're Scott Walker and the problems you've had in immigration, do you want to interject at that moment and open yourself up to talk of a Canadian wall? So maybe there was a decision of, I should not play right now because it's not going to benefit me in the end. The second thing is, you talk to folks today, they're kind of like, well, you know, it's that Midwestern nice thing. Maybe Governor Walker doesn't, it's not in his nature to be a jerk. So he's not throwing the hard elbow to get time on the air and kind of push people aside. He wasn't as aggressive. If you heard people yelling Jake, I would have heard Carly Fiorina's more often, Ted Cruz more often. He was doing it, but he wasn't nearly as aggressive, and maybe it's just not in his nature. He's kind of getting out of his comfort zone to do that. And if you think about it, too, his career in Wisconsin, he's always had, I think, just one person on stage with him. I can't remember a time when Governor Walker's had three even three people to work with in a debate, right?
And there was one more in this debate than the last one. Go ahead, I interrupted
you. So it's a different dynamic. If you look at his past debates, he's always been in a position of strength in Wisconsin. He's had the lead. He's had more money. He's had a good wind at his back. Every debate he's had, he's pretty much been in a position of, okay, you attack me, I'm going to, you know, block your point and pivot to what I want to say. This is a different environment for him where he has to kind of like be aggressive and go after and try and come back from the back of the pack and go after a Donald Trump or something like that and say, hey, you know, it's my turn to kind of be the fighter kind of. It's just a different dynamic for him.
Did you see a Governor Brandon that is not comfortable in this type of format, elbows out with 10 other candidates?
No, I don't think he was uncomfortable in this format. It might be a little bit different than what he's been used to. He might be a little bit of the nice guy thing. I don't think it's up to him. This was a terrible debate format. And to elbow your way in and to slugfest your way in to get your 45 seconds worth, you know, are you really going to step? Will that really elevate you in this debate of some of the things that you need? So, you know, I have a hard time saying, boy, you know, Walker really didn't do well for 34 minutes. I mean, what can the guy do short of tackling somebody or pushing the podium over or stepping out from behind the podium? You know, that's the kind of debate that we watched.
Okay, thank you. The final segment I want to play is the governor's closing remarks, in which he touched all the bases that we are very familiar with. He's still trying to introduce himself to millions of American voters, so let's listen to how he closed.
Well, I turned 13 years old 2 days before Ronald Reagan was first elected. A lot of people forget this, but just a few days before that election, 1980, he was behind in the polls. But I think what changed things was people in America realized they didn't want to hear what was bad about America. They wanted to know how it was going to be better. Ronald Reagan wasn't just a conservative Republican. He was an eternal optimist in the American people, and I am too. So here's what I think will make America better. We need to live in a world where our children are free from the threats of radical Islamic terrorism. We need to live in an America where we have an economy where everyone can live their piece of the American dream, no matter what that dream is. And we need to live in an America where we have a federal government that's not too big to fail, but ultimately small enough to succeed, where we send powers back to the states and back to the people. That's what I did in Wisconsin. When we took on the big government union bosses, the big government special interests, many of whom came in from Washington, to spend millions of dollars to try and take me out because we stood up to them. We didn't back down in any of those instances. If you give me the chance as your next president, I won't back down any day, any way, anyhow. I'll fight and win for you and your families every single day I'm in office.
JR, my stopwatch said that he gave the speech 2 hours and 58 minutes in. My wife had already said, I'm going to bed, Steve. You're getting, yeah, this is part of your job. How many American voters do you think were watching that, which I thought was a pretty effective close?
Well, CNN said last night's debate was his most watched show ever, I think.
Yes.
It still got fewer eyeballs than the Fox one. But for the average voter, probably not many. For primary voters, you know, a decent chunk, but a lot of them are people who are junkies. I mean, they're not like the real person, like my wife, like my mother. They're not watching this debate. They have things to do, kids to take care of, you know, dinner to make. So it's not like it's penetrating the bubble of the average American voter. It is, though, something we're watching, and it feeds the narratives we're seeing today of Walker's still in trouble, his poll numbers stink, rumors about whether his campaign's going to have a shakeup, donors who are, it's just the feeding frenzy, if you will. That's what the result of last night's debate is. The narratives that take off from the coverage of the debate that the average person might see more of on the 5 minutes of the nightly news he or she watches tonight, while making dinner or after having something to eat, you know, that kind of thing.
Was that a pretty effective close, and does it matter when it comes 2 hours and 58 minutes in?
It was a very effective close. It was probably one of the strongest statements that I've heard Walker give since that initial Iowa speech, and that's good. The problem you have here with 2 minutes and 58 into the debate, I'd say it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Because this close now goes on social media. It now goes on targeted message to voter groups that they want. It has legs if they get it in the right place to the right people and let them watch it. You know, 20 million people watched that debate last night. You know, half of them were, you know, running the DVR, dozing off. So does it matter that it was at 2:58 or at 2 minutes and 58 seconds into the debate? I say the legs of that closing statement are beyond the debate. It's beyond the 24 to 48 hour analysis. It's into the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, social media, in ads, in people's homes.
Okay. Now, you have prep candidates, Brandon. So when the governor walks off stage here, if you were prepping him and still working for the campaign and you're not and I understand that, what would you have said to the governor?
What would I have told him to do?
Yeah. If he wants to know, Brandon, how did I do? Your answer?
Oh, I'd say you held in there.
Held in there.
You held in there. You did what you could. You did what you had to. And again, 11 people on a debate stage. Seriously, what more can you expect?
Okay. There's one other part of this that I want to go to. On Monday, the governor went to Eureka College, where Ronald Reagan graduated and, quote, found his voice, according to the governor. And he announced an anti-union program. Again, he rolled out his replacement for Obamacare. And then on last Monday, he said four things. I want to abolish unions for federal workers, create a national right-to-work law, although states could override it, eliminate the National Labor Relations Board, ban federal government from withholding union dues from paychecks if they pay for political activities. Why did we not hear any of this at last night's debate?
Good question. Didn't really come up, though, in the context. That's in his wheelhouse, though. When I talked to Rick Wylie last week, his campaign manager, he told me that the plan going forward is they're going to have a weekly day one promise, if you will, roll out policy from now until Thanksgiving. Then you decide after Thanksgiving what's your closing argument in Iowa. And December and January, you nail that theme over and over and over again for the 2 months until the caucus. And February 1, see what happens. You know, that's their plan, is to try and get back on track, is to focus on the policy part. Because Governor Walker is never going to be an outsider in this field. I mean, he's had good credibility in Wisconsin because what the Tea Party folks and the anti-establishment folks, because he was a Republican and Democratic Milwaukee County run the show. He came to Wisconsin, the Capitol, and took on the unions. You know, he was the fighter kind of thing. But when you're standing next to Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina and Ben Carson, you're not an outsider anymore.
Okay.
So he cannot run on an outsider message. What he can do, though, is say, I feel your pain, but oh, by the way, when you walk in that polling booth on election day and say, well, I like these guys to be outsiders. They don't have a record, though. I have a record. You can trust me to get something done. That's the plan.
Final question on this subject. Where's the governor's campaign? Well, we know what his Secret Service code name would be, Harley. Where does the Harley for President campaign go now, Brandon?
They go to Iowa.
Okay. Do they do anything different?
They ramp it up. I think you see more communications, more outreach to voters, less jaunting around the country, more on the ground. He brings his numbers back in Iowa a little bit. All of a sudden, they go, Walker turned it around. That little kind of mention. There were some of the pundits after the debate today that said Walker did all right. In that format, he did all right. Spends his time in Iowa.
Politico says he's on life support. Excuse me.
Yeah, well, okay, fine. Let Politico say that he's on life support. I think there are probably others that disagree. Remember, Walker has built a strong network in Iowa.
Okay.
Strong network. Not polling numbers. Network. The caucus is all about the network and who goes into those caucuses. So that's where you go. It's not a popularity contest like New Hampshire or other states. So don't lose sight of the structure of the caucuses. If he's built the infrastructure there with the endorsements and the people on the ground and what unintimidated PAC is going to do in that state, those aren't tiny numbers, by the way. I mean, the Walker campaign puts out numbers that says of the dollars they are committing to on the ground and media messaging, they are stronger than any of the other candidates in Iowa. They're doing nothing in New Hampshire, and they got some dedicated South Carolina. So I would look more to the structure that they have set up when they were up here and they were able to do that, as opposed to if they're starting down here, this is not going to happen.
JR, you look for any changes? Rick Wylie told the Capital Times, I'm not going anywhere.
Well,
do you think there is a change in the
There's already been
campaign
a change
hierarchy?
In the campaign because he was supposed to be in California this weekend giving a speech to the Republican State Convention there, and he's going to Michigan and Iowa and South Carolina. Part of the reason is they grew so big so fast that they became almost like a national campaign like in the blink of an eye. But when you build that quickly, they have a couple of underpinning issues that there wasn't a solid foundation in some places. They assumed that the growth would keep happening and the money keep rolling in. All of a sudden, hit some turbulent waters, it becomes okay. Now what are you going to do? Donors get nervous. Stories are in there about the polling numbers. They're pulling back to Iowa and saying, okay, we need to get focused on what can we do well. And remember, we've talked for weeks. Iowa's all about expectations. Walker is, sixth, seventh, eighth in some polls in Iowa, whatever it is right now. If he comes to January 15th and he's fifth in the polls and he finishes third in Iowa on February 1st, he's exceeded expectations. He's got momentum. He's back in the game. So that's what you're shooting for. If you're Walker, you're thinking, okay, I just have to come and show momentum out of Iowa, slug through New Hampshire and South Carolina is my next pick. Because Unintimidated, remember, is dropping $7.5 million on radio and TV in Iowa.
In Iowa.
From now until the caucus, and then it's got $8 million is committed to South Carolina. That's the firewall like what George Bush had with 2000.
Okay, let's touch on a couple of other non-political subjects, non-presidential, non-Walker subject.
Oh, first, political, right?
Everything. Yeah, that's a good point, but that's a wonderful segue. The Democrats, Peter Barca and Julie Lassa offered their alternative to repeal and replace, to use a term, WEDIC. And I found it very intriguing because you and I have heard the criticism, well, Democrats, you're in the minority, you don't have to offer any ideas. So it's interesting to me that their plan would create a State Department of Economic Opportunity to work on job creation, business incentives. It would be run by a 12-member advisory board. The DEO would administer venture capital block grant programs, verify applications and jobs created data, which WEDIC has gotten in a lot of trouble for not verifying. Then secondly, it would create a private Badger Innovation Corp owned by state government. The Innovation Corp would conduct trade missions, marketing, fundraising, and develop economic strategy plan. JR, this plan is DOA because yes. Senator Fitzgerald said that WEDIC, for all its problems at the top, is a very successful at the local, right? But it's a DOA plan.
Lots of projects in my district, he said, are successful because of what WEDIC is doing. So.
Okay, but at least there's a dialogue here, and the Democrats have finally said, here's what we think is a better idea.
Look at the plan. Part of what it is accentuating the problems WEDIC has had and saying we would fix them. These Republicans are going to go along to get along. We want to fix the problem. That's part of it.
Okay, and then on another note, let's talk about a personnel issue. Senator Leah Vukmir was elected Assistant Senate Majority Leader. Mm-hmm. She was elected to the Assembly in 2002. She elected to the Senate in 2010. She was unanimously elected. She's first vice chair of the controversial ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council. And the leadership spot was open because former Senator
Paul Farrell
resigned to become Waukesha County Executive. Mm-hmm. What intrigues me, three of the five positions in the Senate are now held by women. Is Vukmir much of a rising star?
Absolutely. She's also a favorite of the conservatives in southeastern Wisconsin, especially talk radio. So you're seeing an interesting development in the Capitol in general, where southeastern Wisconsin is getting more and more conservative all the time, emboldened in part by talk radio. And you're seeing an outstate party that's not quite as conservative sometimes. And it's just an interesting dynamic to watch of the rise of that southeastern Wisconsin thing. And Lee's a perfect example. She was in the Assembly, came to the Senate in 2003,
elected to the Assembly, 2010 to the Senate.
2010, quick riser, Mary Lozick, also from southeastern Wisconsin, New Berlin, Scott Fitzgerald, not far outside of southeastern Wisconsin, where you want to draw that line, if you will. Started the talk radio signal in his backyard, but there's a lot of that stuff, you know, a lot of power going on right now with that caucus of southeastern Wisconsin.
Leah Vukmir, rising star, Brandon?
You know, she is amongst the conservatives, and she is sometimes, of those who speak up, she's louder. She hasn't let the ALEC controversy, you know, dull her sword. So she kind of picks and chooses her battles. She's not necessarily in every fight in the sandbox. So I think you have to watch her. There's not much time left in this session to bring your star up even further. So I think you look into the elections to see what role she has next year and then see who wins.
I want to come back to something you said very quickly. She picks her fights because she was a member of Joint Finance, but you know there were only two or three issues that she really took the lead on. So you're right, she picks her fights. Okay, before we go away, JR, developments, update us on John Doe because there's stuff breaking every hour, it seems, today.
Well, the Wall Street Journal got more emails that were under seal in the Waukesha County Court.
And didn't do them in the news columns, but in an
editorial page again. Basically what they show is that people associated with the John Doe investigation, including Shane Falk, the former staff attorney, had discussions in 2013 about, okay, if this goes to court and there's a review, what happens to the Supreme Court? Will people have to recuse themselves? Because you've looked at the groups that were investigated or touched upon, I don't want to say it, in the Joe 2, they included Club for Growth. You know, they included the groups that were spending heavily in Supreme Court races. So they speculated about this. Well, might they have to recuse? What about Joanne Kloppenburg, who ran for Supreme Court in 2011? Those groups spent a lot of money against her and for Justice Prosser. What's going to happen then? It just is another black eye for the GAB. Now, this week, Scott Fitzgerald said, hey, we're working on a bill still. That he wants to do two different, you know, like the elections and ethics board,
go
like they used to be.
Go back to that pre-2007 model.
But what did he say? Agreement's too strong of a word. We're having talks back and forth.
Right.
They're having issues figuring out, well, who's going to be on these boards? They talk about county clerks. Might they be involved? Might judges be involved? Might they be partisan employment? They're still talking about what this board's going to look like. Let me talk about this for now. I think Dean Knutson from Hudson talked about his plan. He's going to have a bill any day now back in December of last year. They still haven't got a bill that's introduced. Now they've got drafts going, they're working on stuff, but because they can't quite get on board of both houses, what's it going to look like? And oh, by the way, in the Senate, there are a lot of people who voted for a GAB just 8 years ago, whatever it was, that this is what they want to do. Now you're going to say, well, a do-over, if you will. They got to get something right before they take it to the full caucuses.
Meanwhile, there's a line of pretty important people, pretty important Republicans in the Capitol that say Kevin Kennedy should resign. Today, Alberta Darling.
Again, she and John Nygren, both co-chairs of Joint Finance, did this a couple months ago, saying he's got to go.
Robin Voss
said it last fall, one of her luncheons in October, that he needs to go. With his latest Wall Street Journal story, Alberta says again he needs to resign. And Kennedy, so look, these emails show that if you look at the Capron decision, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision about when a judge must recuse him or herself
out of West Virginia
from a case, you have to be cognizant of that and have to prepare for that possibility. It's just smart. And it touched both sides of the spectrum, he pointed out. Then with the Darling saying you need to resign, said, talked about all the things that they've done, how they've been open, and oh, by the way, these unfounded attacks on my character. You know, talking about that. He's striking a little more of a defiant tone, if you will, the last few months. And like last fall, they're more conciliatory now and saying, hey, you know, we're doing our job kind of thing. So
just amazing. That Capitol never stops. Brandon, thanks very much for coming back.
Thank
how do you,
you.
How do you like that pundit hat? Does it fit?
Every once in a while it slips, but I try and keep it going straight.
Remember, great. We have six more debates going.
That's right. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for this week.